Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, One Person, One Vote Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 4th, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Evenwell v. Abbott. As required by the Texas Constitution, the Texas legislature reapportioned its Senate districts after publication of the 2010 census, formally adopting an interim plan that had been put in place for the 2012 primaries. Plaintiffs, who are registered Texas voters, sued the Texas governor and secretary of state, asserting that the redistricting plan violated the one-person, one-vote principle of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause by failing to apportion districts to equalize both total population and voter population. A three-judge district court ruled in favor of the state officials. On appeal, the question before the Supreme Court was whether the three-judge district circuit correctly held that the one-person, one-vote principle under the Equal Protection Clause allows states to use total population and does not require states to use voter population when apportioning state legislative districts. By a vote of 8-0, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the three-judge district court. Justice Ginsburg delivered the opinion of the court, holding that constitutional history, precedent, and longstanding practice demonstrate that a state may draw its legislative districts based on total population. The Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined Justice Ginsburg's opinion for the court. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Justice Alito also filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which Justice Thomas joined except as to Part 3B. To discuss the case, we have Andrew Grossman, who is partner at Baker & Hostetler LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Grossman.
To begin with, I think I'll just cut to the chase. The central question in Evenwell versus Abbott was, what is the meaning of one person, one vote? Does it turn on raw population, in other words, equalizing just the number of bodies in any particular legislative district, or does it turn on the number of eligible voters so that each vote that's cast is approximately the same weight? The court's decision issued this morning it indicates that the answer is, who knows? Await a future case, I suppose. Let's begin with a little bit of background on the case. The one-person, one-vote standard is a slogan, an idea, that arose in the court cases in the early 1960s concerning the apportionment of both legislative seats in state legislative bodies, as well as apportionment of congressional districts within the states. Slightly different cases, slightly different approaches, but in each instance, the idea, as explained in a series of court cases, was to limit states undertaking the most discriminatory types of apportionments so as to equalize in some amount the vote weight as well as perhaps the population in any given legislative district. The court allowed a little bit more leniency with respect to state legislative districts and required somewhat more strictness with respect to congressional districts. The problem is that at the time that this doctrine arose, and the one person, one vote for, state legislative bodies as a concept was based on the Equal Protection Clause. The court's idea was that equal protection of the laws guaranteed some right to an equal vote. The court was never really forced to confront the question of what it is exactly that's being equalized. If you look at the cases from the early years up through almost the present, you see two distinct concepts being bandied about. The first is the idea of equal vote weight, or put differently, anti-vote dilution. When there are legislative districts that have the same number of persons in them, but different numbers of eligible voters, the result is that votes can be of different weight. A vote in a district with more voters is going to be worth less than a vote cast in a district with fewer voters. The other approach, of course, is some type of equalization of representation. That's the idea that for every given legislator, there are a similar number of persons that that person represents, whether or not those persons happen to be voters or even eligible to vote. And the court had never really distinguished between those two. In the early years, there was no real reason to do it. There was not a very large population of unlawful aliens in the United States. And the deviations between districts, while there were some, were not particularly extreme. But in recent decades, particularly due to such things as large waves of unlawful immigration into the United States, as well as the propensity of certain communities of undocumented immigrants to settle in proximity to one another, the result has been, in some instances, very large disparities in terms of voting weight. And that's really what drove this case, Evenwell versus Abbott. The plaintiffs in the case are Sue Evenwell and Edward Feniger. Both of them are Texas residents, and they live in counties, in voting districts, rather, that for the state Senate have disproportionately large numbers of eligible voters, or put differently, very few numbers of individuals who are not eligible to vote. Relatively speaking, if you run through the numbers, votes in their districts are worth a full third less than a vote that would be cast for the state Senate in Brownsville, Texas, an area right up against the border with Mexico. In Brownsville, Texas, there are a lot more undocumented immigrants, and given that those individuals are unable to vote, and given that the districts are drawn based on equal population, the result is that somebody who votes in Brownsville, their vote is going to be worth a lot more. That was the basis of the case, challenging this as something that violated Ms. Evenwell's and Mr. Feniger's equal protection rights under the Constitution. That argument was rejected as a matter of law by a three-judge district court, and the plaintiffs appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and the court agreed to hear the case on the merits and render a decision, which is what it did today. The oral argument, I think, in this case surprised a lot of people because there really was a lot of sympathy for the position of the plaintiffs in this case and a lot of questions about what it was exactly that states could do to reduce disparities in voting weights. The justices seemed to realize that argument that a lot of the court's prior decisions had turned on this idea of avoiding vote dilution. And while there was some pushback by some of the justices that it might be unwieldy or difficult to implement some type of limitation on different vote weights for states engaged in apportionment. At the same time, particularly Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justice Kennedy, seemed to recognize that some type of overlay of equal vote weight, maybe something where maximum disparities are limited to a certain threshold to avoid the most egregious and extreme disparities, would be something that would be workable and could, in fact, be easily implemented by the states. Well, suffice it to say, that's not how the decision today turned out. The majority decision was by Justice Ginsburg, joined by the Chief Justice, Justice Kennedy, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. There are two concurrences in the case, concurrences in the judgment by Justices Thomas and Alito, with Justice Thomas joining part of Justice Alito's concurrence. In other words, it was a unanimous decision that states, in fact, are not required to equalize vote weight when they undertake apportionment. Let's discuss the majority decision. The bottom line, of course, is that it's permissible for jurisdictions to base apportionment of legislative districts on total population. The focus of the majority of Justice Ginsburg's majority decision is on the apportionment of the U.S. House of Representatives among the states, those House seats among the states, by raw population. That's specified, of course, in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution and as it was later superseded in the 14th Amendment. Section 2 of the 14th Amendment provides that representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state. The majority decision goes on at some length explaining how that the Constitutional Convention examines several possible different means of apportioning House seats among the different states and how it arose at this particular thing. There are many quotations and lots of snippets from various contemporary sources regarding that particular decision. And the court concludes, based on that history, that it simply could not be that the Constitution, in both Article 1 and subsequently in the 14th Amendment, calls for the apportionment of congressional districts based on total population, but simultaneously prohibits states from apportioning their own legislative districts on that very same basis. So in other words, the real reasoning here and what the court is focused on is what is the so-called federal analogy. In other words, that states have to that states' representative organs have to be organized in roughly by analogy to the apportionment of U.S. House seats. The problem is, of course, that this is certainly something that the court has considered previously among the early days of the one person, one vote doctrine, when states argued to a different federal analogy that they could organize perhaps the upper chambers in their state legislatures to resemble the United States Senate, which, of course, is not apportioned based on population. In that instance, of course, the court rejected the contention, saying that there simply was no analogy. But in this instance, the court has gone the other way, saying that the analogy holds, and that the fact that House seats are apportioned based on population controls the day. So the argument that the court's reasoning in so many of its prior cases had turned on vote weight, the majority simply rejects the implication that the court necessarily meant what it said, pointing out that in a number of different cases, while there may have been language relating to vote dilution, at the end of the day, the court had always wound up in pretty much every case looking at total population as the measure for proper apportionment. And of course, there are scattered quotes here and there in other cases where the court referred to population. Now, I would say there is a bit of an ambiguity there, because when the court referred to population, very rarely did it actually decide or define or present any reasoning as to what population exactly it was talking about. So in this sense, the majority decision really sweeps under the rug a lot of language throughout over a dozen separate court opinions over a period of 3 to 4 decades. What also seems significant to the majority was that not only do you have the precedents, not only do you have this federal analogy to the Constitution, but you also have an unbroken practice where at this point there are 50 states that base apportionment of their legislatures in varying respects, but in varying particulars, but all based on total population. And certainly the court's prior cases have allowed that. Finally, the majority decision closes with a brief pay-in to the concept of equal representation. In other words, the idea that there's something inherently virtuous, that it's somehow essential to our democratic character, that every representative represents a similar number of persons, and that each person is entitled to, I suppose, an equal slice of representation. This mostly seems like a make-weight, however, in light of the court's decision, which is, of course, not that equal representation is mandated, not that use of raw population is mandated, but only that states aren't required to look at voting or voting eligible populations. In other words, that they may use raw population, but the court never at any point really says must. In this respect, the majority opinion appears to have almost had its head chopped off. So much of the reasoning, so much of the discussion, so much of the historical analysis is really focused on bolstering this idea of apportionment based on raw population and this equal representation concept. But at the end of the day, the court is unwilling to come out and say this is really what's called for. By all indications, maybe that was the cost for Justice Ginsburg of securing a majority decision in this case, and in particular the votes of the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy. And perhaps without that limitation, her opinion might have only won 4 votes and resulting in a very fractured decision by the court. Let's discuss briefly Justice Thomas's concurrence in the judgment. Now, Thomas starts out by saying that he agrees with the majority position, not for the same reasoning, but because in his view, states may apportion based on raw population. But of course, he doesn't stop there being Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas's thought is to look back at the Constitution and, of course, at original meaning. And when he looks at original meaning, his view is that you really can't see anything like the one person, one vote concept there. Certainly, many cases of the court do stress equal treatment of voters, and the court struggled to identify the underlying theory of one person, one vote. And of course, as Justice Thomas points out, today's decision doesn't really do a lot more to elucidate exactly what that theory may be. The result has been that there's not really any firm guidance for the states as to what it is they may and may not do. There still is a great deal of uncertainty. And the reason for that Justice Thomas identifies is that this isn't anywhere to be found in the Constitution. The Constitution, as he puts it, identifies no particular way of choosing between the different competing theories of representation. That question, to Justice Thomas, is left to the people and therefore by extension to the states. As he points out at framing, only 6 of the 13 states based representation in both houses of their legislatures on population. In other words, there was a diversity of practice. His view, at the bottom line, is that the one person, one vote concept has arrogated to the judiciary important value judgments that the Constitution reserves to the people. And so far as the Constitution is concerned, there is no single correct way to design a Republican government. The people get to choose. No other justices joined on to Justice Thomas's concurrence, but like so many of them, it really is a path-breaking decision and certainly could augur for some very substantial changes down the road by the court. Finally, there's Justice Alito's concurrence, joined in part by Justice Thomas. The main question at issue in this case, are states allowed to use total population for apportionment, could be decided in about a paragraph. Of course, the court has let states do that in prior cases. States have wide, you know, range in these things, and there's nothing in the Constitution that says they can't. And that's about a paragraph right there. The more complicated question he points out is the dispute between Texas and the United States government over what a state may do. In other words, may a state instead choose to apportion based on equal vote weight or citizen voting age population or other measures that accord with voter population so as to equalize vote weight. Now, he also accuses the majority of conducting bad historical analysis and embracing the federal analogy. As he points out, the argument that the court embraces, that the majority opinion embraces, is the same one that the court has rejected in Reynolds and in so many other cases, and it isn't any more persuasive now than it was then. The framers of the Constitution, as well as those of the 14th Amendment, as he puts it, were concerned about the apportionment of power among the states. They were not concerned about abstract questions of representation and Republican government. If you take one person, one vote on its own terms, there simply is no basis in the Constitution to necessarily choose among these particular competing theories. Having discussed the decisions a little bit, let's see what type of tentative conclusions we can reach by looking at what the court did. Obviously, the most straightforward point is that the court has reaffirmed the status quo. At this point, 50 states use total population numbers in apportionment in various respects, and that allows, in some cases, enormous disparities in vote weight, as in Texas. Sometimes the value of different votes can differ by 40% or 50% or more, and that's something that the court has said in this case is perfectly fine. It simply doesn't matter. What's interesting is that the court did not bar the door to experimentation by the states. That may include undertaking apportionment based on measures that are correlated with voting population so as to equalize more greatly vote weight, or it may include adjusting the population base in certain respects. As the majority opinion points out, some states already exclude non-citizens, non-permanent residents, non-resident military personnel, inmates who were not state residents prior to incarceration, and other types of non-permanent or non-voting populations. That's certainly somewhere where states have leeway to experiment, maybe. And I say maybe because if you take the majority decision at its word, in other words, you take its reasoning at its word, its reasoning suggests that all those things are off the table and that apportionment simply has to be based on some gross measure of raw population. But if you take the majority decision in terms of what its technical holding is, states have options at their disposal and they can certainly experiment and try different approaches to see what works for them. In other words, what concept of democracy and representation meets most with their people's approval and accord. Potentially, future cases will tell. And in that sense, a third conclusion is that there is all this support in the majority decision for a subsequent decision that would block that type of state experimentation. The language that the majority uses is, quote, the theory of the Constitution. And that theory, it says, is equal representation. Again, take the majority at its word in terms of that language, and it would seem that that would bar attempts to define the population at issue. But there are cases that point the other way. Burns is one, and it's something that really seems to get short shrift in the majority decision. So it's simply impossible to tell after Evenwheel exactly where this stands. A broader point, and something that people have said in recent years, but I think is now true even more now than in the past, we're all originalists now. This may be Justice Ginsburg's first opinion that is so self-consciously originalist in its approach, focusing on the Constitutional Convention, the drafting and ratification of the 14th Amendment, and the views of the framers and of other prominent individuals at the time. Now, let me be clear. It seems, reading it over, as I have in preparation for this call, that it's not really very good originalism. There's not really a good focus on the textual basis. And the textual basis that there is, which concerns the apportionment of House seats among the states, is completely disconnected from the question at hand, which concerns apportionment within the states. Most of the argumentation consists of strung together quotations from old cases and from the constitutional conventions. Many appear to be taken out of context. And it's hard to tell exactly that it amounts to much at all. So in this, there really is a great resemblance, I think, to Justice Stevens's dissent in Heller versus United States, as well as to Justice Breyer's decision 2 terms ago in NLRB versus Noel Canning. You know, both were very self-conscious attempts to undertake an originalist method by justices who are not associated with originalism and who generally are not thought to think in that particular way and to reason in that particular way. But let's put all that aside for a minute. Let's put the criticism aside and just think about how far we've come. You need only compare Justice Ginsburg's majority decision in Evenwill to the early one-person, one-vote cases like Reynolds and like Westbury, just to see the enormous shift in constitutional reasoning. The focus on original meaning and the founding era, look, it may be window dressing. Who knows? But it's there for a reason. To demonstrate the legitimacy of the court's decision. And it seems to me that even if the court gets it wrong, that's very important. And it is, of course, a very fitting and appropriate legacy to Justice Scalia, even if, again, the result may or may not be the wrong one, and even if the approach isn't perfectly applied. Let me conclude with a minor procedural point, something that for some people will be of enormous interest and for other people will simply be baffling. This case was not brought, as most Supreme Court cases are, on a petition for certiorari, where the court gets to decide at the outset whether or not it's going to hear the case. Instead, it was brought as a direct appeal from a 3-judge district court, as is typical for redistricting challenges. When the court decided that it was going to hear this case on the merits rather than simply summarily affirm the lower court with a one sentence or very brief decision that just said the lower court got it right. When the court announced that it was going to hear full argument and issue a full decision in the case, a lot of people were wondering, if that was because the court had serious questions about the merits in this case, or if it was simply because it was a direct appeal and the standard for the court to hear a direct appeal perhaps is somewhat lower. I think given the decision here that the court was unanimous in the end, at least as to the result, I think we can probably safely conclude that the court is applying a slightly lower standard, perhaps a very much lower standard, than it would in typical certiorari cases where the court decides whether or not to take the case. Now, that's a big deal given the decision earlier this term in a case called Shapiro versus McManus, which makes it easier for people bringing redistricting challenges to get into 3-judge courts, which then gives them a direct route up to the Supreme Court. So I think in some instances, you may see a lot more cases going this way and proceeding to the Supreme Court on an expedited basis, to raise basically whatever issues fit into that jurisdictional grant. Again, perhaps an obscure point, but something that may be significant in redistricting litigation going forward.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.